supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. They walked out of class in March. They marched on Washington a couple of weeks later, and now the question is whether they'll go to the polls in November. Teenage activists made major noise this year, and some data suggests that young people could be a rising force in Pennsylvania's midterm elections. But as Keystone Crossroads' Avi Wolfman-Arendt reports, there's plenty of room for skepticism.
This form is actually a federal form, so it's for all states.
On a recent Tuesday, volunteers combed the sidewalks outside Auden Reed High School in South Philadelphia. They're looking for unregistered voters, people like Emily Clevin.
I am 19, and I am ashamed that I didn't register earlier.
Clevin hails from the Philly suburbs and recently left for college in North Carolina. Over the last 2 years, she's gotten a lot more interested in politics and says she's not alone among her friends.
There have been a lot more grassroots movements trying to get that to happen. So if we can follow through there, I think we're going to see a lot more change.
Clevin is in South Philadelphia to see one of those grassroots movements in action. The Road to Change is a 16-city summer tour organized by many of the same young activists who held major rallies after the school shooting in Parkland, Florida. At their town halls, they push youth activism and youth voting. And students like Ethan Block from New Jersey aren't shy about getting that message across.
There are going to be those guys who are like, oh, you know, you have no idea what you're talking about. You're a kid. Stay in school. Screw those guys. Like, we don't need to hear what you have to say.
But will the sound bites translate to the ballot box in time for the 2018 midterms here in Pennsylvania? Jarrett Smith with the progressive group Next Gen America says it will. His organization is spending more than $3 million to register young voters in Pennsylvania, and he believes it's working.
The fact that we're leading by every state the highest rate of increase in youth voter registration is a really big deal.
Smith is talking about a new report from the data firm Target Smart. They looked at registration patterns across the country and found that in Pennsylvania, the number of people under 30 registering to vote spiked significantly after the Parkland shooting.
That's going to be enough to really make a difference and get some of these congressional candidates elected.
But Christopher Nicholas has heard this song before.
I think you'd have to put me in the category of I'll believe it when I see it.
The veteran Republican political consultant doubts that young people are going to storm the polls and sweep out the GOP.
I can see why Democrats are kind of lurching towards that, because they've been saying for years this is going to happen, and at some point, maybe like a stopped clock, they'll get right once. But again, I think you have to look in previous cycles and see what the registration was.
Keystone Crossroads did just that, to see if this recent registration surge has made a real dent in the overall look of the electorate. Short answer, it doesn't seem like it has. In May of 2014, Pennsylvanians aged 18 to 24 made up 8% of all people registered to vote. In May of 2018, that number was 8.1%. It's a similar story for voters aged 25 to 34. And then there's the question of whether the young people who've registered will show up at the polls. 22-year-old Marcus Mooley can only hope.
We'll see. That's the best answer I can give. I can at least guarantee my friends are going to do it, because I'll push them, but I can't speak for all the youth in Pennsylvania.
The question this fall is pretty simple. Will the youth of Pennsylvania speak for themselves? Avi Wolfman-Arendt, Keystone Crossroads.
Admissions to New Jersey's largest group home provider were halted by the state last month in response to ongoing allegations of abuse and neglect of clients resulting in injury and even death. WNYC's Audrey Quinn has been following the bellwether behavioral health homes in New Jersey for close to a year and joins me now with details. Audrey, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about bellwether behavioral health homes and the clients they serve.
Yeah, so Bellwether Behavioral Health, I actually started out following them in Florida, and it's been in recent months that I've turned to focus on them in New Jersey. It's a company that has been around now for coming on 50 years. They started out in Delaware, and they were largely autism kind of institutional facilities. They spread to Florida, and they had a very institution-like setting in Florida, and then it's in New Jersey where they really branched out into these group homes.
Although Florida, in addition to New York, Maryland, and Delaware, have already cut ties with Bellwether, what Yes. are the types of problems that New Jersey is now dealing with?
It's interesting. It's really been a similar pattern in each state where the state gets very dependent on Bellwether for the services they provide because Bellwether is unique in that they don't turn away more difficult clients in the way that other providers often do. Bellwether's kind of the reputation is they take anyone. But what starts happening is you start kind of hearing, it seems like in each state you start hearing whispers about the way clients are being treated, an over-reliance on restraints, kind of physical ways of holding clients down, a lack of documentation of what's actually going on in the homes, and then seeing client injuries seem to escalate, and then in each state there has been a number of client deaths.
So you're saying they're kind of a place of last resort to the extent that they take anyone, but aren't there any qualifications to becoming a client?
So typically these are services that cost upwards of $100,000, $200,000, even $400,000 a year, and those are typically covered by a Medicaid waiver. And so the folks who are qualifying for a Medicaid waiver of this sort are folks who meet what's called an institutional level of care criteria, typically people who would have trouble taking care of themselves on their own.
It's alarming to read in your report that the instances of abuse or neglect at Bellwether homes are 13 times the average rate of other large New Jersey group home companies.
Yeah, that was in the past year. And this is something that New Jersey monitors every year. And it was really in this past year that spike happened.
In the course of your reporting, were you able to speak with clients or employees or administrators there?
Yeah, all of the above. I'm going to introduce you to the Sacco family. They're this super tight-knit family from Trenton. They have 8 adult kids. And their youngest kid, Abdulay, he has autism. He's also intellectually disabled. And Abdulay went into a Bellwether behavioral group home back in 2012. He was 20 back then. But as the years go on, his family starts to get really worried about how he's doing in this house.
He has scratches. He had wounds. They were not healing.
Open wounds.
Open wounds.
And what would you say?
We were asked, what happened? Why anybody is treating this? Oh, we didn't see that.
Yeah.
So that was Abdulay's mom, Emma, and his sister, Fatu.
Bellwether is now owned by a New York City-based private equity group, Wellspring Capital. What do you know about their oversight of Bellwether and the business model?
What I know about Wellspring's role in Bellwether largely comes from talking with prior employees. A number of prior employees say that that Wellspring had a pretty heavy hand in the management, or has a pretty heavy hand in the management of Bellwether. Kind of the way that all private equity groups work is that they buy companies and then they try to make them more profitable. And it looks like what Wellspring was trying to do with Bellwether was basically bring the cost down as low as they can by hiring fewer employees, by hiring less qualified, lower paid employees, by offering fewer and fewer educational and therapeutic services, basically just trying to do as little as they could and not get sued.
From your article, we learned that national spending on autism is expected to rise 70% in the decade between 2015 and 2025.
Yeah, and I actually found that number numerous times in private equity fund publications. This is something that investors are starting to eye as, hey, here's a possibility for money making.
Audrey Quinn, thank you so much for bringing this issue to light on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
WNYC's Audrey Quinn. New Jersey is proceeding with a plan to install enough offshore wind turbines to power 1.5 million homes by the year 2030. And that's part of a state goal to generate all of its electricity emissions-free by 2050. Asbury Park press reporter Russ Zimmer looked into the status of offshore wind farms in New Jersey and joins me now. Russ, thanks for being here on Newsworks Tonight.
You're welcome, Dave.
Safe to say the political climate is kind to the extent that Governor Phil Murphy is on board, as was to a varying degree Chris Christie before him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big part of the puzzle, is that this kind of languished under the Christie administration. Governor Christie was the one who signed this into law. He signed something called the Offshore Wind Economic Development Act back in 2010, but never really went anywhere until Phil Murphy was elected, and his eighth executive order was written basically to reinvigorate the offshore wind program. So a change of leadership combined with some of these macroeconomic factors, the building up in Europe, that has really paved the way for offshore wind to have an opportunity here in New Jersey.
So accurately, it does come out down to what ratepayers can stomach and who will absorb the burden, especially for the huge initial investment.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably three main factors in offshore wind energy and making it work. You know, first, it has to make business sense, obviously, for the company to want to get involved. The second part of that is that you have to have a friendly government policy. New Jersey and a lot of the Northeast have started to adopt these renewable energy credits, where they essentially tell a company, we will help you absorb some of these initial costs by agreeing to pay extra for the energy you produce from clean energy sources. But the third part of that, of course, is that it has to be something that ratepayers aren't going to revolt over.
Have offshore wind farms been established in other states and up and running, and the ratepayers are not revolting?
Well, pretty much every other state in the mid-Atlantic and up to the Northeast is undergoing, they're somewhere in the process of developing their own wind energy projects, and part of that is figuring out how much they're willing to subsidize these industries. The thing to remember is that it's going to come in chunks. So, for example, in Maryland, their public utilities oversight bureau has approved a figure for some of the megawatts to be produced from offshore wind that amounts to basically what they're saying is $1.40 every month for the typical home. That covers that specific project. Now, as they scale up and add additional projects, you will have additional surcharges on top of that. So it's $1.40 here, maybe it's $1.50 next time, so on and so on, and you know, eventually might stack up into being something that ratepayers are finding hard to afford.
Though in terms of timing, is it tougher to gain traction now that natural gas seems to be so prolific and so cheap?
Well, that is the struggle, because you're talking about a megawatt of energy might sell for $54 on the wholesale market right now, in the New Jersey area. And Maryland, which has very similar wholesale prices to us here in New Jersey, just entered into a contract saying we'll pay you $132 per megawatt of electricity that you produce from offshore wind. So essentially they're saying, you know, you can charge us 2.5 times as much as we would pay for something that's more or less likely to be generated by natural gas. And we're willing to take that on because of our priorities now, including things like climate change and moving away from fossil fuels.
So perhaps it's not a plan, it's merely an opportunity. And I suppose we're not going to see big offshore wind farms anytime soon. What's the next step or steps?
Well, it is, I think you're accurate. We're at least 2022 before we would see construction and installation off of New Jersey coast. There's a very long stretch of time where you're going to be getting permits, you're going to be doing environmental assessments, surveying, all these types of things that need to happen before you take on a gigantic development like an offshore wind farm. These are you're talking billions of dollars for each of these projects. So the company wants to do its due diligence. Regulators want to do their due diligence, and it just takes time for something of this scale to come to fruition.
Well, then you and I need to talk next in 2030 to see how close to the goal they came.
Sounds like a plan.
Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
All right, you're welcome.
Asbury Park Press reporter Russ Zimmer. When Scott Petry took over as executive director of the Philadelphia Parking Authority last December, he promised to reform the scandal-plagued agency and, quote, question everything about its operations. Now, 8 months in, the authority's new chief wants to work on another persistent problem, traffic. As Jim Saxa of WHYY's Plan Philly reports, Petry wants lawmakers to give the unpopular PPA more authority.
Don't get Scott Petry started about traffic.
Oh, congestion.
While Philadelphians appear to be driving less, the time it takes to get across town has gotten worse. There's plenty of blame to go around. Uber and Lyft drivers stop mid-block to pick up passengers. Trucks double park to make deliveries. It's impossible to make a turn because there are just so many pedestrians crossing the street. Traffic is bad. Petry thinks the PPA can help.
We have an idea that we should be part of the problems in solving congestion, particularly in Center City and University City.
To do that, the PPA would need lawmakers to give it more power. Last month, PPA officials met with a group of state legislators to go over their proposals. That includes adding a 50-cent surcharge to all your taxi and ride-hailing trips in Philly. That money would go to beefing up enforcement efforts against Uber and Lyft. Petry also wants the legislature to authorize every city in Pennsylvania, not just Philadelphia, to use cameras, radar, and other technology to enforce basic traffic violations. When I asked former Governor Ed Rendell what he thinks about the idea of convincing lawmakers to grant the PPA more power, he can barely get a sentence out.
You know, the parking authority is... This guy may be new, but parking authority doesn't have the creds.
Rendell says the PPA isn't exactly the most popular state authority, and this legislative push is unprecedented.
This would be a new approach. Other than revenue stuff, I haven't seen much efforts to do much in Harrisburg.
SEPTA and city officials say they support Petry's ideas for improving traffic. But usually, they prefer to work behind the scenes, quietly lobbying lawmakers to make legal tweaks and then carefully coordinating any public announcements. Petry hasn't done that. Instead, the former state representative is running a very public campaign for change. Some, like Rendell, think that might backfire. But Petry says he's undeterred.
If we fail to succeed, then we'll just continue to persevere. I was always in the legislature, and I intend to be here like a dog with a bone. If I get a bone in my mouth, I'm not letting go no matter what.
Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
For years, Wilmington's community has clamored for a first-class indoor sports facility, as well as more recreational opportunities for kids. And now, one is under construction. WHYY's Chris Barish reports that the developer promises that, quote, underserved children will be able to use the facility.
Iron workers and crane operators are moving huge red-brown steel beams into place on a long-neglected industrial strip south of Wilmington. On a stretch of South Market Street known for strip clubs, junkyards, and a dirty oil recycling facility, a phoenix is truly rising. It's the new home of the 76ers Delaware farm team, the Bluecoats, formerly known as the 87ers. But the 150,000-square-foot structure that seats 2,500 promises to be much more. Not only will it feature NBA G League basketball, elite youth soccer players and other athletes will train there. And there's a third mission: to provide free or low-cost recreational, educational, and leadership programs for kids living in poverty. That's critical in a city hard hit by gun violence, where too many youngsters are lured into gangs and drug dealing. That's music to the ears of a few kids who were shooting hoops under a searing sun this week in the impoverished Southbridge neighborhood, about a half mile away. 10-year-old Cadence Tan lives in a Wilmington Housing Authority apartment.
I think it's a great thing for the sisters. That should be cool. Are kids like allowed to go in there sometimes to do activities and stuff like that and play basketball?
12-year-old Christian Brown seconded that notion.
I think that is actually pretty cool because so when it like gets real hot, we could go over there and play basketball. We just don't have to stay outside. I think it's great for us to get exercise.
Well, it won't be as simple as going to one of the city's handful of community centers. Steve Cavalier of Bicini Pollen Group says all kids will be encouraged to participate in structured activities. There's a soccer program, plans for city youth basketball and flag football leagues, and a summer learning program that includes computer coding, dance, and theater as well as sports.
You can't just walk in and play on the courts or the turf or anything like that, but we will have planned programs for everyone.
Allison Wendell, the head of Southbridge's respected Neighborhood House Community Center, welcomes the facility but has some worries, especially with the nearby Albert Palmer Elementary School slated to close next year. No one involved in the project has contacted her agency, which offers a full array of programs for kids and families.
I'm always concerned about reinventing the wheel. We already have all these great youth programs in place, and now we're going to bring one more. And it'll be one more that we have to compete for the funding for. And I hope that we can partner with them to bring even more positive activities for youth.
Cavalier says the center should be open by December, and the Sixers themselves will have at least one open practice there each season. From the Delaware Desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.